Do you have anything that you want to say, get it out of your system?
I was going to say, two episodes in a row. I'm famous.
You are. You're the chosen one.
I am the chosen one. I've been chosen, see, one time's a coincidence. Two times is, what is that?
A choice. Less of a coincidence.
There's a saying for it. It's like,
once is a chance, twice is coincidence, three times is a pattern. I just need to make it to three.
I don't think you will.
Oh, okay.
I do have... Well, the next one is going to be the exclusive episode, which I still need to draft and figure out who I was going to have do it with me. I was thinking of asking Amanda, but we'll see.
Okay.
All right. The wind kicks up snow so cold and so fine that it creates a mist and fog dense enough to turn man into shadows. He is a shadow walking, hunched forward like he is burdened by a great weight. In the midst of World War II, the number of men who became missing is staggeringly high, and the question becomes focused on the reality that they can't survive forever. Even those out of the confines of battle-ridden ground can find themselves desperately clinging to life. In the shadows, you can hear them whisper, "I am a pilot, and I fell from the sky. I am alive, but dead to everyone. I am still here." Welcome back to Tragedy with a View. I am your host, Kayla.
And I'm Sam.
And Sam is back again.
Woo!
And I have two things for housekeeping real quick. One, Sam did episode 10 with me way back now, and it was about the disappearance of Barry Zeldin.
Oh.
And a lot of...
The crotchety old man that disappeared.
He did disappear.
Because he was not friends with anyone.
He had friends. He just had more enemies.
And they were adversaries instead of rivals. Rivals is the best positive way to say it.
He had friends, but he had more... He did have more rivals than friends. Anyways, the podcast that I listened to, that I pulled a lot of my information from, was... called Wicked Garden Podcast. It has since changed names. Mike, the guy who hosted the podcast and basically did all of the investigative research on this particular story, is going in a different direction right now, but he's still like staying on top of the Barry Zeldin case and following up on leads and whatnot. And he had one of his listeners send him the episode I did on Barry Zeldin. And so he...
Yay, collaboration.
Yeah, he reached out through email and let me know that there was an update to the podcast, which I listened to, and there's not really an update on the case. It's just kind of more talking about how a little bit more about how like the police work in the area and things that you might not know from a public view. But also in his email, he mentioned that something just popped up this last week. We're recording this on the 20th. So last week, pretty much as current as you can get, some new information has...
Breaking news!
Yeah, arrived. And he didn't really elaborate, and I didn't really ask because I'm not investigating this. I'm just retelling what other people have investigated. So I think it's cool that there's potentially a resolution coming. I don't know. Like I said, I don't know what information came about.
But we'll have to go back to the episode and see what my prediction was to see if I was right. Because I feel like that's the one that had, like, you went over a bunch of different options. And mm-hmm. I was like, this one. I like this one. Aliens. Probably not. But we'll have to go back and confirm. Keep score.
Yeah. We'll have to listen again. But the second thing I wanted to mention is that I have been doing a lot of running lately because I am running an ultra marathon in September, which also means I am doing a lot of running, and the lots of running that I'm doing currently is only going to get worse. And I just want to let everyone know that if you come here for an episode on a Wednesday in August, September timeframe, and there's not an episode there, don't panic. I just needed to sleep more than read and research and write. So
I'll keep her in check.
Yeah. If I'm trying very hard not to let that happen. I'm trying to kind of like get ahead, so that way when the time comes where I do need to sleep more than anything else, I'll have the space to do that. But if something falls off and I don't get an episode out, don't panic. It's not going anywhere. I will get you extra at a later date. But yeah, that,
leave a comment on social media to make sure she hasn't gone missing.
Yeah, I mean, that would be pretty terrible if,
and then she will send you the ZZZ emoji. You heard it here first.
I won't be quite so cheerful if I don't get enough sleep. So that's all I wanted to say, that, you know, the podcast isn't going anywhere. I just have other things going on that,
but Kayla is going somewhere on a run.
I am running very far. Anyways, enough about that. We're going to talk about
White Walkers. That was my first reaction. Game of Thrones, White Walkers. All right, continue.
Yeah, I actually know that reference.
Nice. If you know, you know.
If you know my lack of movie show knowledge, then you know. Or you don't know, like me. Anyways, we are going to kind of do a quick overview, not on a location this time, but rather very, very, very brief rundown of World War II. This is scratching the surface basic. So World War II was the deadliest conflict in history, involving more than 30 countries, and the war was sparked by Nazi Germany's invasion of Poland, which occurred in 1939, and it ended with the Allies defeating the Axis powers in 1945. The war split the world's nations into two opposing military alliances. The Allies included Britain, the United States, the Soviet Union, and France, along with others. There are others besides these ones that I'm naming. But then the Axis powers included Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, and Imperial Japan. It is estimated that there were 50 to 85 million fatalities during the war, and this includes 15 million military personnel and over 38 million civilians. The Soviet Union and China suffered the most fatalities, with a combined total of 42 to 47 million.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting thing, that everyone forgets about China being involved in World War II, but they mm-hmm. were like just almost secretly amassing major casualties. I think that's an interesting thing mm-hmm. for me.
And then on top of this, there were nearly 6 million Jews who were murdered in an act of genocide by Nazi Germany. On December 7th of 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on the island of Oahu, Hawaii, and that same day, the United States declared war on Japan, entering the Second World War. So we're focusing specifically on the United States because of this story. So that's when they entered the war, and the war effectively ended the Great Depression. That was a worldwide economic crash causing businesses to shut down, factories to close, homes and businesses were foreclosed on, families couldn't afford food, and the cycle seemed to just continue because people couldn't make any money, depleted their savings. They then didn't have any money to spend and no money to put back into the economy. So the cycle just kind of continued on and on and on. And the war in the United States caused men and women to find purpose and jobs in supporting the war efforts. And overnight, the unemployment rate fell from 25% to 10%. Leon Crane grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where his parents immigrated to from Ukraine in 1913. Louis, Leon's father, was 21 years old when he came to the United States, and Sonia, Leon's mother, was still a teenager. Together, they had four children, three sons and one daughter, with Leon being the youngest. His father owned an auction company where he would buy businesses that had collapsed and then basically sold off everything for parts. And this was actually a really good thing, and it kept his family in a good financial position throughout the Great Depression. Leon would end up going to Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT, and was always intrigued by aviation. At MIT, he studied aeronautical engineering. And then, along with his two brothers, they got called into service. Leon was sent to Alaska on October 10th of 1943.
Drafted, probably.
I believe so. I believe all three of them were drafted. So Leon was sent to Alaska, and then his two older brothers, Morris, was sent to Europe, and Nathan was in the Pacific. Leon was stationed in Ladd Field, which is located in Fairbanks, Alaska, and he had the title of first lieutenant. It was December 21st, 1943, and it was so cold outside. Everyone was moving to the underground tunnels that they built to allow people to move from building to building without going out and being exposed to the cold. They still dressed in several layers, but tried to do everything they could to prevent themselves from sweating or getting wet, because the moment they stepped outside, any beads of sweat or water would turn to ice.
That sounds very uncomfortable.
Yes, it does. Leon was running late to a test flight, and he knew that he was going to be flying with Second Lieutenant Harold Hoskins. He was running through the tunnels to try to get to the hangar as quickly as possible, and he went past one of their convenience stores that, I mean, when they, like when I was saying that everybody was moving into the underground tunnels, it also includes like the convenience stores where they could just stop and grab and buy something real quick.
Chew it over with a Twix.
Yeah. So Leon ran past one of these convenience stores and then decided, because he knew that Harold was always smoking a pipe, that he would grab a couple boxes of matches for him on his way. So
that sounds like some foreshadowing.
It's important. It's how he ended up with a life-saving measure. Anyways, so Fairbanks, and therefore Ladd Field, was one of the areas that had massive flows of planes and equipment running from the United States to the Soviet Union. The planes and equipment would start in the United States, where they were built and shipped or flown to Alaska, where they were then handed off to Soviet Union members in Ladd Field, and then the planes would be flown over the Bering Sea to Siberia.
That's interesting that they started in Alaska, because you'd think that the weather might be bad and it's like, all right, just go to Washington or California. It must be a lot closer.
Oh.
I mean, no. Alaska's huge.
There's actually, that's one, it is closer. That is a very important part of this. The second part is Alaska is an important step in this, because it's the closest weather-wise to the Soviet Union and Siberia weather. And because the planes were being manufactured in the lower 48 states, which has nowhere near the same harsh and cold climates as in the north, that once the planes then made it to Alaska, there were crews there who were able to fly the planes and provide reports, which then allowed designers to tweak and modify their designs to accommodate the horrifically cold and brutal climate. So they often found that the cold caused oil lines to seize up, wiring became extremely brittle and easily broken, hydraulics would no longer work, and almost every onboard system on the plane initially had issues due to the cold making them unreliable.
Kayla knows about lines getting cold in the winter with your coolant.
I do. The planes were being utilized more and more during the war, and it became a fact that if you did not have a planes or bombers during the war, you would lose. The state of Michigan's Willow Run Aircraft Factory, which was built by Ford Motor Company, started cranking out B-24s at a high rate. The Willow Aircraft Factory was roughly 80 acres of assembly lines that built the planes start to finish. In fact, they had flight crews that were sleeping at the factory so that way the planes could be airborne within hours of being put together. And I've already told you this fun little fact, but I'm going to tell everyone else here, and I'm pulling this directly from the book.
I also have facts too.
Okay. There was a team of midgets.
Dwarfs.
As they were called then. Who were put to work crawling into tight spaces to hammer some of the plane's more than 313,000 rivets.
And then when I was told this fact, we looked it up, and apparently dwarfism is approximately 1 in 20,000 births, and the population of the United States at the time was like, don't quote me on this, but it was around 147 million. And so that ends up being only 6,000 dwarfs. So some of them, of that few, were recruited, drafted, most likely.
To build planes.
To build planes.
Yeah, specifically so that way they could fit into the smaller areas and do some very important work. Because if a plane falls apart, you're done.
It's not good.
Yeah.
And that happened very often, unfortunately.
That planes fell apart?
Oh, yeah. It was, they were not built very well.
Good to know.
It was a very big complaint. Good. That's actually what Catch 22 is about.
Oh, okay.
Which is not a good book, but essentially Catch 22 is about a man that's trying to get out of service in World War II, and he's a bomber plane gunner, which is the person that's in the bottom of the plane that's shooting like a gun down. So basically when they crashed, he would be the first one to die. And it was the most dangerous position. So basically he faked injury, and it's basically this guy going crazy and acting like he's injured to try to get out. It's satirical work, but
okay.
Yeah, it was a very not good thing.
So when you said that it was not good, do you mean the book's writing was not good or the information just in general?
It's a weird book. It switches perspective on characters every chapter. Okay. And weird characters. So,
okay,
it just doesn't make sense. I didn't like it. Maybe other people like it.
Okay. All right. So on this day, Leon and Harold, along with three others, would be getting into a B-24 to do some feathering tests, which required them to get to a certain altitude before they shut down one of the four engines and determined where the props of the engine needed to be adjusted to in order to provide the least resistance of airflow. This is a really important task because if you cannot properly feather a downed engine, it can cause drag, which will strain the remaining engines and potentially cause the plane to stall. And if the plane stalls, it then becomes harder to handle, restart, and it will crash.
So they did that while in the air?
Yes.
I bet you they don't do that in the air anymore. Bet you there's a big wind tunnel. That sounds very dangerous.
It does sound extremely dangerous. So B-24s, especially at this time, were ginormous planes. They are 67 feet long and had a wingspan of 110 feet. The area of the wings is almost 1,050 square feet, which is essentially the size of a house. Small house.
My house.
In comparison to some...
The house that we are in right now.
The house that we're in right now is roughly the wingspan of the planes. The B-24s can fly higher, longer, and faster than B-17s and generally are known as a bomber. On December 21st, there was a significant amount of cloud cover and there was a lot of wind as they moved higher up in altitude, and the wind was predicted to become continue to increase throughout the day. Leon's job would be the co-pilot to Harold, and he would be making sure that the plane was staying level, along with checking the fuel and loading the parachutes so that the participants in this test would be able to use them if they had to evacuate the plane.
I feel like my comments are about to be very relevant.
They are very relevant.
I'm glad that I'm being proven correct, unfortunately.
Obviously. So along with Leon and Harold in this plane for the test would be First Lieutenant James Seibert, who would be in charge of the equipment that tested the feathering and monitoring engine oil pressure, and this would have him sitting in the back of the plane. Staff Sergeant Ralph Wentz would be operating the radio, and he would be sitting directly behind the cockpit. And then Master Sergeant Richard Pompeo, who would be acting as crew chief and assisting with takeoff, and would be in the hatch behind Harold, kind of next to Ralph. In particular, the B-24 plane that they were on today was known as Iceberg Inez, and at about 9:40 a.m., it was taxied to the runway, and then they took off and climbed into the sky.
Actually, do you know when these planes got their name? Do they just, like, once it gets out the assembly line, they're like, hey, we're going to call this one this?
I don't know.
Because they all had a name. It's like a boat.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I would guess that the crew, like, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I feel like a crew would be like have a specific plane.
Yeah, I guess my comment is that this is before it's even given to the crew that would fly it in war, like they're testing it.
But if the crew who was flying it from the factory to Alaska was the same crew that would be then taking it to
potentially
the Soviet Union, I'm not sure. That's a good question.
We'll have to look it up.
So once in the sky, they found the clouds to be very dense, but Harold wanted to go to an area called Big Delta, which is a smaller airbase about 60 miles southeast of Ladd Field. Every half hour, Ralph was contacting Ladd Field to relay first their location and second that they were still doing fine. And at this time, turbulence wasn't understood the same way we understand it now, and there was the simple idea that clear skies meant smooth flying. The radio had a reach of about 65 miles. However, transmissions would still be sent even if they were out of range, as Big Delta would potentially be able to pick them up and then relay the messages to Ladd Field. About 10 miles east of Big Delta, they finally found a break in the clouds that they had been looking for in order to perform the feathering test at the altitudes of 15,000, 20,000, and 25,000 feet, or 4,600, 6,000, and 7,600 meters. The air temperature was reading negative 70 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 57 degrees Celsius. Because they were already flying at 20,000 feet or 6,000 meters, they decided to start their test there. Despite some minor glitches with the gauges, everything went smooth and they started their climb to 25,000 feet or 7,600 meters. Because Harold wanted to stay within the opening in the clouds, he decided to do a bit of a spiral on his way up to higher elevation, which is not as bad as it sounds.
Like a barrel roll?
No.
Okay.
No, he wasn't. It wasn't.
So he was horizontally.
He was horizontally like winding himself up.
He's like
within this channel that was open in the clouds.
Oh. So it he wasn't moving forward. He was like, he was basically going down a toilet or going up a toilet. He was spiraling.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's.
Everyone like my toilet reference.
It's exactly the thought.
It's what planes do if there's nowhere to land at an airport. They fly around in a circle.
Yeah, he flew around in a circle that was within this open channel in the clouds. So as he was doing this, Leon got out the logbook to start making notes when suddenly the notebook was ripped from his hands and he and Harold were pinned to their seats. The B-24 was caught in some turbulent air and was now in a spin, and Harold and Leon gripped the controls to try to gain control. They quickly figured out one of their engines had failed, and therefore they were having a really hard time getting control of the bomber. The instruments went dark.
And this is why you wouldn't do tests like that now. In the air. I bet you there's like a wind tunnel now that they do this in. That just sounds super dangerous. Any case, continue. I already know what's going to happen.
The instruments went dark in a mechanical failure, and just then the spinning stopped. While they were still rocking side to side, Harold and Leon had gained control, but they could tell that they were moving too fast, and so Harold pointed the nose up to slow the bomber down, and when he did this, control was again ripped away. This time they spun in the opposite direction, and they were pointing straight down toward the ground. There was a loud crack that sounded through the bomber as the elevator system went out, which is what allows a plane to fly horizontally, and without this, there was no other choice. They were going to crash.
And that was very common.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sure.
I will note for Catch-22, it was specifically European bombers because of the anti-aircraft activity. So I don't really know on the Pacific side how different it is, but continue.
Okay. So Pompeo opened the bomb bay doors. Everyone started to fit themselves into their parachutes, and Pompeo leapt from the plane. Leon was next, and as he made his way to the door, he noticed that Ralph was not where he normally sits and assumed that he had already leapt out of the plane. And then he noticed that Harold was struggling to snap his parachute on. Harold saw Leon hesitate, shouted at him to go, and then Leon was falling through the frigid air. He pulled the ripcord to allow his chute to come out, and then he was drifting as he watched the bomber flip and spin out of control like a paper airplane gliding through the air. The bomber,
my paper airplanes don't fly like that.
Okay, a paper airplane made by a six-year-old.
Okay.
The bomber was already on fire, and when it struck the slopes, a ball of fire erupted into the air. Just before Leon landed in the snow, he thought to himself that the fire would be good because this would be a good indication for where rescuers could look. And then he realized that he hadn't seen anyone else leap from the plane. So as he was going, like, floating-ish down, he could see one other parachute, and this was likely Pompeo.
Likely, huh?
Likely. Once Leon took a moment to focus on himself and what he had, he realized that he had left his mittens on the plane, and his hands were now exposed, and the threat of frostbite ran high.
I bet you I know what he remembered! You'll find out here in approximately...
two sentences.
10 minutes. Oh, two sentences. Okay.
Him, he had 3 pairs of wool socks inside of mukluks to keep his feet warm and dry, his silk parachute, which had doubled as a way to keep his hands warm, and a sleeping bag, as silk is known to be a great insulator. He also had the matches, a letter from his father in his coat pocket, and a Boy Scout knife.
And this is where we give Kayla a clap for her amazing foreshadowing writing.
I tell the story directly.
Indeed.
Besides a small amount of exposure through the Boy Scouts, Leon had no other outdoor or survival experience. Leon first spent time to cut down branches to spell out SOS with an arrow that was pointing towards the crash site in an effort to help be located, and then he took time to light a fire.
Quick question. So where they were traveling to slash where they were coming from, where he crashed, was it like mountainous or like what kind of terrain is he in right now?
In short, think Yukon Gold Rush area. So
I don't know what that means.
Very, there are mountains, there's river, there's fields, there's a lot of,
so like forest, like outback.
There's a lot of nothing.
Okay.
So
is it flat?
No.
Oh.
No, it's, and I guess what I mean by there's a lot of nothing is that there's a lot of like no people being there. In short, the area being kind of like the Gold Rush.
Like rolling hills with many trees and mountains sometimes?
I would not call it rolling hills. There were mountains because Alaska has mountains, Ohio has rolling hills.
So not, like, what about like Mount Rainier?
It,
like where it's like there are big mountains, but most of it's just kind of like...
He didn't have to climb mountains
okay.
to get out. I'll say that. But I guess what my point is that it was an area that had been in a short time industrialized and then abandoned because the area for gold was just not in this particular location. So there were flat areas where people had worked through, and then there was a lot of wilderness areas that hadn't been touched. As the sun was setting, Leon had no idea the closest road was 75 miles or 120 kilometers away, and the last known location that the plane had been in was more than an hour before the crash, meaning the search area now had a 200 mile or 322 kilometer radius to it. Leon got out the matches and used spruce needles to help start a fire, but his fingers were already starting to go numb, and after he lost four matches, he decided to get out the letter that his dad had written to him and used the letter to light a fire because it caught on fire easier than the spruce
needles.
I mean,
good thing he had that.
Very good thing that he had that. Ultimately, he was successful, and then he wrapped himself in the silk parachute, tucked his hands into his armpits, and settled in for the night and wondered how long it would take for him to die. Back at Ladd Field, it didn't take long for them to realize that something had gone wrong, as the protocol was that radio contact be made every 30 minutes, and they were due back shortly after the sunset, which was at 2:41 p.m., roughly 8 hours after they had lost contact with the iceberg, and Ned's crews were sent out to see if they were able to find anything. And for the first 2 days, about 20 search missions were made. Most of them flew between Ladd Field and Big Delta because that was the known flight pattern.
Well, if I haven't been on this show enough, I know exactly the problem. They're not where they're supposed to be.
They're not where they're supposed to be.
What a surprise.
And it's not necessarily they're not where they're supposed to be. They're, for whatever reason, the radio contact was unsuccessful at letting them know where they were and where they were going. So there was that. And then also when the wind turbulence picked them up and just carried them away, it blew them in a direction that was not the direction they were flying. So there were a couple of
yeah, it's just so rough thinking about it on a general level. It's like you're going out to rescue these people in an already unknown area, and the area that you think that they are is like very possibly not where they are.
Yeah. And on top of that, Alaska in December is snow. It's a lot of snow. if you're flying at a certain altitude, the snow is reflecting things. And you want to know what else is reflecting things? Metal aircraft. So it might just blend in, and you're not going to see that blip of like, oh, there's something there. You're just going to see.
They need Logan's metal detector.
I wonder if that's.
I don't know if they would have something like that back then.
I mean, a metal detector on a plane would probably be pretty hard to use since.
Well, it depends on how like directed you can make it. It's like they have the boom microphones that are like shotgun microphones that are very specific mm-hmm. to a specific location. It's like if somebody talking over here, it wouldn't actually catch them. So it would, you direct it specifically at a person. But yeah, I don't think they would have something.
Not in 1940s.
No.
So day after day, the results were continuing to be negative, and the crews and those searching knew that the window to find the crash wreckage and any survivors was already very small due to the weather. The search was only considered to be a days-long process, not weeks or months until they were found. And it wasn't just because of the weather. It was also because they were in the middle of a war and the personnel to find missing service members was not yet available. On Christmas Eve, December 24th, there were 16 planes that were assigned to search, and they knew that the skies were going to be more clear than they had been during this entire search period.
What was the start day again?
The 21st.
Okay.
It was around this time that others started to question if they should expand the search from around Big Delta. And because there was a lack of communication between the iceberg, Inez, and the commander, they really had a hard time figuring out what to do and what direction to go. And they felt like they couldn't be flying blind around Alaska looking for a plane. And because they were already running low on time, they decided to schedule the planes to fly the way that it had been planned, which was basically just around the Big Delta area. The morning of December 22nd, Leon's hands were getting a pasty white-looking color, which is the first stage of frostbite, and he decided that he could not stay put. And because he was near a small river, he decided that he was going to follow it downstream. When he came up to the crash site, when he looked up to the crash site, he could see that it was no longer smoldering. And so he knew that the smoke and flames being a sort of alert was no longer a viable option. To try to help starve off hunger, Leon started to eat small amounts of snow. But because snow can damage the tissue on the inside of the mouth, it is often not a good source of water. So the snow, because of its texture, can cause inflammation in the mouth, mucous membrane, and the tongue, and this will actually increase the body's need for water and therefore increase your thirst.
That's very interesting. Like, is it certain types of snow, or like if you eat a lot of snow, or is it just like micro damage, and then if you do it a lot,
correct. If it's micro, it's micro damage.
It's like if you accidentally burn your mouth.
The more you eat the snow, the more damage you're going to sustain.
That's so weird. It doesn't hurt.
I would imagine so, yes.
No, I'm saying it doesn't hurt. And it's like you wouldn't know until it's too late, really. It's like you're more normal, or you're more used to eating cold things. Like we have ice cream and all that sort of stuff.
But ice cream is not the same texture as snow. Yeah. It's the texture that causes...
It's concrete, like avalanche snow. Don't eat avalanche snow.
Don't eat snow.
Okay.
Especially if it's yellow.
Jeez.
Okay. Leon was really surprised to learn about the brain's ability to create things from nothing. He often imagined the snow that he was eating was actually the flavor of his favorite milkshake. And when he put the snow into his mouth, he would actually be able to taste these different flavors. At one point, Leon saw that there was an opening in the ice on the river, and he saw that water was bubbling up through the opening. So he got down on his belly and slid across to where the opening was so that way he could drink the water from the river. As he was settling down for the night, he took a good look at his hands and noticed that there was no coloring in his fingertips and his hands were moving extremely slow and felt numb. He realized that what he was doing was foolish and that it would be better to stay with the wreckage because that was going to be the best way for someone to find him alive. So he decided that he would stay put for a week, and that's about how long he thought Ladfield would take to do their search until they called it off.
I think that's reasonable.
I do too. By Christmas Day, December 25th, Leon was already entering the process of starvation. In short, when you stop eating, you no longer get the calories your body needs to survive, and it will start firing off survival mechanisms to prolong life as long as possible. One of the first things that happens is the brain is the only one to get the body's glucose reserves and proteins while the gray matter shifts into an energy-saving mode. This means that your brain is focusing on keeping your body alive, not making the best choices. A person's blood volume will decrease along with that. The amount of plasma, red blood cells, and electrolytes that are all part of many different processes within the body also decrease. And one of these things that is affected is muscle function. Because of the loss of muscle function, it is determined that muscle is no longer needed. So after about a week of not eating, muscle begins to be broken down in order to keep your vital organs operating. As the electrolytes and salt levels of the body drop, your muscles begin to cramp, and usually by day 10, the mind is moving towards surrendering to the decline of your body. There was, however, life around Leon. He was often seeing red squirrels and frozen moss poking up from the ground. He first tried to eat some of the moss and found that even though the texture wasn't great, it had nearly no flavor. But when he tried to swallow even a small amount, it would get stuck in his throat and he would often gag until he threw up. He then turned his attention to trying to get the red squirrels, and he first tried using a club to smash them, but he learned that he was too slow. He tried a spear, but found that he was unable to control it well enough to hit a squirrel. He then tried to use some of the rubber cords that were attached to his parachute and make a bow and arrow, which he also very quickly discovered the cord did not have enough elasticity in it to project the arrow far or fast enough to be able to get a squirrel. So then he threw a temper tantrum and threw rocks at the squirrels instead. Did not get any.
Oh, too bad.
Too bad. The days.
If only there were some moles.
The days passed slowly, but at the same time, blurred together, and the next thing he knew, his week was up and he was going to have to walk out if he was going to survive. Back in Philadelphia on December 29th, a child who delivered telegrams from the Western Union that were issued by the Secretary of War made his way down the road to Leon's parents' home, where he delivered a small envelope. In it was a typed letter stating the Secretary of War desires me to express his deepest regret that your son, First Lieutenant Leon Crane, has been reported since 21 December in Alaska. There was no other information on it other than the promise to pass along more information as it became available. So as Leon gets around and figuring out his game plan, he decides that he's going to head directly in the direction of Big Delta. However, his hands were getting worse due to the cold. They were now becoming unresponsive, and he tried to keep blood flowing to them by squeezing his hands into fists, and he found that he couldn't even do that.
Yep. I mean, that's the first sign. It's like if you can't touch your thumb to your pinky, that you're entering hypothermic state. So I would imagine that you just like can't squeeze,
mm-hmm.
or it just gets worse and worse.
Well, there's also a swelling aspect to it too, and yesterday was like the first really long hot run that I've had, and my fingers swelled, and I honestly didn't realize that my fingers had swollen up until I went to my running vest has two pouches for water on the very front, and so you can just like grab the top of the water and like lean down and drink some right there. And I went to grab the water, and I was like, wow, my hand is really hard to move. And I like looked at my fingers and they looked like little sausages, and I was like, this is in completely a different way, but this is probably how Leon felt with his hands when he tried to make a fist and they just wouldn't go.
I'm sure it is similar.
Probably more alarming for him, because like when you're hot, you just have to cool down, lay down in some shade, and you're gonna cool down a bit more. Then,
well, both ways. You just, it's the interesting idea of the steady state for the human body,
mm-hmm.
and the extremes on both sides.
Yeah,
and how they react similarly.
Similarly, I think cold would be worse, though. In my opinion, cold is way worse.
I would rather die in a desert than in the cold. So
he had been able to make a fire each night and warm his hands that way. However, allowing your hands to become frostbitten and then warming them and continuing to rewarm them every time they become too cold to handle is actually worse than just letting your hands be cold, not quite to the level of frostbite setting in, but an uncomfortable temperature. Because as the tissue and blood vessels freeze, the capillaries and blood supply pull farther and farther from the skin's surface. In its place, ice crystals will begin to form due to the human body holding a lot of water naturally. And in minor cases of frostbite, being warmed will allow for the pins and needles feeling. However, more severe cases have a much more painful process as the nerves come back to life. And the freeze can actually be so severe that when you warm the area up, lesions erupt onto your skin from all of those frozen pieces coming out. So,
not what you want.
It's not what you want, but it's still good because the pain means that the tissue and the nerves are all still alive.
Well, that's what I was saying. Honestly, the pain's good because he might like fall asleep or something and just die.
Yeah.
Well, just like the whole, like you would just, if you have no pain, then you would just be able to.
It's a lot easier to slip away.
Give up or sleep or. Yeah. So
once the tissue dehydrates in the freeze, that's when everything begins to die and it never returns to its prior state. So in addition to this, Leon was beginning to notice that he would have spans of time where he couldn't remember and he couldn't snap out of it. One morning he lit a fire and the next thing he remembers is blinking and seeing that the hearty fire he had just built was barely glowing embers. And this spacing out is another step in the process of starving to death. Along with this, many people in survival situations begin to find their minds play tricks on them, and in a desperate attempt to find safety, a person may act in ways they otherwise wouldn't. So Leon started to have all of these forces working against him. It was unbearably cold. He was alone. There was no food, only frozen water. His hands were in bad shape. He's starving, and his mind is telling him now is the time to hike out. What he didn't know was that as the crow flies, Big Delta was 70 miles away from him, or 113 kilometers, and about 150 hiking miles, or 241 kilometers, when it came to someone who not only knew Alaska and its terrain, but was also skilled with a map and compass. So Leon goes plowing through the snow that was deep as his waist. He found walking extremely difficult because he was pushing through the snow and he would find rocks and logs underneath of it that he couldn't see. And he would then be forced to maneuver around the rocks and logs. And so for 2 hours, he pushed himself forward again through waist-deep snow, zigzagging back and forth, trying to keep his focus on the course. And when he turned back to see how far he had made it, he was only 300 feet or 91 meters from his starting point.
Yep.
So at this point, his lower legs began to grow cold and he realized that this would be a mistake. So he turned around and headed back down to the river. On December 30th, he again set off, this time down the river on top of the ice. He decided to use the rocky edges.
Refer to episode. I don't remember what episode it is.
With the guy.
Yeah, that was on the ice.
Yeah, who floated down the river. But this is a different situation because the river is frozen.
Yeah, well, gotta start somewhere.
I mean, it's a valid thought. Very valid thought. I don't know that I would walk on the river, but... So he was using the rocky edges of the riverbanks as a guide to keep him on the river so he wouldn't accidentally lose it. By 3 p.m., the light was fading, and as Leon took in his surroundings and looked for a place to set up his camp, he stopped dead in his tracks at what was before him. Some distance away, high in the air on some sort of platform, was a tent. At first, he couldn't believe his eyes, and he thought that he was hallucinating, but then as he made his way towards it, the tent and everything else became sharper and more clear, and he started to realize that this was, in fact, what he thought it was. Leon started yelling and running and calling out in desperate hope that someone would be there, and then as he got closer to the platform, he saw something big off to the right side. Turning, there was a small cabin. Changing direction, he went straight to the cabin, still screaming in joy, and when he got to the door and turned the knob, the door swung wide open. The inside was just large enough to hold a table, a cot, had a very small kitchen space, and a wood-burning stove. It was just tall enough in the center, where the ceiling vaulted to a peak that Leon could stand upright, and he was just shy of 6 foot tall. Inside the cabin, Leon found a huge sack of sugar, cocoa, 2 cans of dried milk, 6 cans of baking powder, and a box of raisins.
Wahoo!
Yeah. Leon made his way to the tent where he found hammers, a drill, saws, several cords of rope, 2 folded tents, 2 cans of tallow, which is rendered animal fat and is essentially the animal version of coconut oil. And the next day, Leon momentarily left the cabin with the supplies he found tied into a makeshift pack. But after a few hours, he realized that this plan was foolish and he needed to head back to the cabin because a snowstorm had moved in.
Why wouldn't he just stay there to get his strength back? But continue.
30 hours of walking later, Leon was back at the cabin. He started a fire in the wood-burning stove and then went to sleep on the cot. When he woke up, he suddenly realized that there was a second pile in the tent that he never looked at.
Second pile?
Uh-huh.
What? I don't know what pile means.
A pile of stuff.
Oh.
It was underneath the tarp. And this was a huge mistake. Under the tarp was 25 pounds of flour, 30 pounds of rice, 30 pounds of dried beef and beans, a bearskin, wool blankets, 2 pairs of overalls, long underwear, 3 pairs of wool socks, 2 pairs of muckluck boots, snowshoes, a .22 caliber rifle and ammunition, candles, tea, dried eggs, powdered soup mix, dried onions, more sugar, more cocoa, and best of all, a pair of moose hide mittens. In the pile, there was a box which had etched on the top of it, Phil Burrell, Woodchopper, Alaska, which meant that at the minimum, Leon now knew where he was. On January 10th, 1944, the families of the missing crew of the Iceberg Inez received a letter officially stating the search was called off due to the fact that no wreckage had been found despite day and night searches, and that given the weather and lack of a wreckage, the chances of survival were remote. As the days passed, Leon knew more and more that he couldn't stay in the cabin. There wasn't enough food to make it till spring, so on January 19th, he set out again with a small pack of food and a tent with the intent that he would see if he could find anything that would lead him to civilization. His plan was to follow the river and go until he was about halfway out of food and then turn around and head back to the cabin. He took with him the rifle and was beginning to shoot small grouse and squirrels that were native to the area. On his second day out, he found a second log cabin This one was similar and in this one was smaller and in much worse shape, but he did find a sleeping bag to add to his supplies. On the third day, he found a third cabin. This time, the ceiling had caved in and there was nothing salvageable inside. But at this point, he was about halfway through his food and he decided it was time to turn back. But what he found was that dotted down this river were cabins, and he felt that it would lead to a town somewhere. He just needed to get there. Back at the first cabin, Leon began planning again, trying to figure out how to carry all of his supplies for his venture of an unknown length.
He needs a dog sled.
But he was in luck. He was able to create a sled.
Wow, I'm good at this. I'm not looking at the notes here.
I keep them secret from Sam, so he's reading the room. Or just me.
Just too good at this.
He just knows me. So he was able to create a sled to pull behind him using the rope, a small wash tub, and the frame from a skylight. The bottom of the sled had two runners on it, similar to skis, and fully loaded, it was about 120 pounds. On February 10th, Leon woke to a sharp snap, and for a moment, he was extremely confused. He then realized it was the ice on the river buckling. For a few days, the temperature had hovered close to slightly below freezing, and with the warmer temperatures, the ice was beginning to weaken. This also meant that Leon's plan to walk on the river was less stable, and he suddenly felt the need to go right away. So on February 12th, he repacked the sled, headed out with the mission that he would track down the owner of the cabin, Phil, and thank him. The sled, though, was heavier than anticipated because in his rush, he felt like he couldn't make decisions and he packed anything that he could fit, which was making it heavier and harder to move. On top of this, the rails had blunt edges that acted as a plow and simply piled the snow in front of them until Leon could go no farther. And the two rails created a very small amount of weight distribution, making it extremely hard to pull. But pull it he did, and over the next 27 days, Leon pulled and pulled and kept putting one foot in front of the other. On February 14th, Leon stepped through some thin ice, and luckily his mukluks were waterproof and his leg and foot were safe. Your face.
She's trying to bait me there.
2 days later, a larger hole opened beneath him, and this time he plunged into the water to his chest. The fact that he was roped to a sled kept his head from going under the water and having him be swept underneath the ice. Using the sled as leverage, he pulled himself out of the water and then ran to the bank of the river as ice instantly began to freeze on his clothing. He started a fire as he felt the water seep down to his skin, set up the tent next to the fire, and then stripped naked and hung his clothes to dry. Once his clothes were dry enough, he put them back on, shot a squirrel to eat with dinner, and then curled up in the tent to sleep. Farther down the river, Leon found yet another cabin where he decided to stay for a few days. Then, as another blizzard moved in, for some reason, he decided he had to get moving again. What freaked him out, you might ask? He found wolf tracks near the cabin, and he wanted to be as far away from them as he could get.
I think they would catch him still, because they travel a long distance.
They are very good at running down their food. Yes. So into the blizzard he went, and on March 3rd, there was a moment where he couldn't move any farther. He pulled and pulled against the ropes, but he couldn't budge the sled. With the sudden realization that the sled wasn't just not moving, but actually pulling him backwards, he looked in horror to see the back of the sled tipping into the river where the ice had broken beneath it. In desperation, he pulled and pulled and pulled, and then the ice gave way beneath him. His legs plunged into the water as he sat down on the ice, hoping it would hold, and it did. He got one leg out and then the other, and then realized his sled was floating.
Oh.
Carefully.
See, I was right. You do need to refer to the... He's going to about to travel the river.
Carefully, he was able to pull it from the water and repeated the process of warming up, lighting a fire, setting up his tent, and then stripping down to warm his clothes next to the fire. But it was after this Leon knew that he needed to travel lighter, not only because the ice was becoming thinner, but also because he was only going about 4 miles each day.
That's not many.
That's not very much. He recreated his pack with ropes and the blankets and packed what he could and left the sled behind. The entire time, the temperatures ranged from negative 20 degrees to negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit, or I didn't write down the Celsius conversion, but I know that negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit is also negative 40 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
So there's that. On March 10th, Leon found a section of packed snow not far from the river, and as he looked closer at it, he realized that this was absolutely not natural and decided to follow it. As he did, he began to hear something. First, there was the flap in the wind, like that of a flag or clothes on a line, and then he heard a dog begin to bark. A short walk later, a cabin came into view. Smoke plumed from its top, and standing in the doorway, smoking a cigarette, was a man by the name of Albert Ames. He lived in the cabin with his wife and 3 kids, and after a short stay, Albert took Leon to Woodchopper, where he was able to thank Phil in person for the supplies in his cabin that was 95 miles or 153 kilometers away. And then Leon returned to Ladd Field. What Leon didn't know about this area was that it was directly tied to Gold Rush days, and years prior, Phil, who owned the first cabin that he came to, along with the owners of the other cabins, allowed their cabins to be used as drop points where they would have food and supplies intentionally left, so that way if anyone was left working in the fields looking for gold and they didn't get out before winter hit, they would have something to help them make it. Phil's cabin was the last one to have food stocked in it.
That did happen in the olden days. And it was in Frieren. If you haven't watched Frieren and you like anime, you should watch Frieren Beyond Journey's End. There is an episode where this happens.
Okay.
And they meet someone else in the cabin because that person stuck because there was a blizzard.
Yeah. Yeah. So the intention of these cabins was to allow the person to be able to hopscotch his way to town as weather permitted. Leon had utilized these cabins and the stock one last time, completely separate from the gold rush, as he made his way back to civilization 81 days after the crash. In October 1944, Leon led a recovery team to the wreckage of Iceberg Inez, and here they were able to find the remains of James Seibert and Ralph Wentz. On June 23rd, 1994, a helicopter was flying over the Yukon Charlie Rivers National Preserve, and inside of the helicopter was Douglas Becksteed, who was a National Park Service historian. He was on the flight to take a look at the Iceberg Inez from the air, and they could see that the nose of the bomber and 2 of the engines were completely gone. In fact, the wings looked much the way they did when the plane left Ladd Field, except for 2 spaces where the engines had been seemingly appeared to just be simply ripped away. In August of 2006, Doug returned to the crash site with a military forensic team there in an attempt to find evidence of the missing members of the team, Pompeo and Harold. They spent a week at the site collecting everything they could find and sending it to a lab in Hawaii for further testing. In 2007, the items and bone fragments found were conclusively connected to Harold Hoskins. The remains of Pompeo were never found.
Dun, dun, dun.
And that's what I got.
Yeah, because he made it out. I wonder where he might have lived.
Richard.
And then he had to try to travel too.
Yeah. So in a completely separate story, Richard Pompeo had already had been in like a survival experience shortly before he got onto this plane. So,
it's like Final Destination.
It's a little bit. That's a little.
That's dark.
That is dark. Sorry. But, yeah. So Pompeo is likely the parachute that Leon saw as he was floating down. He probably was the one who got out before him. Cyber and Wentz were, their remains were apparently still with the wreckage in 1944 when they went back, and then they were able to conclude that Harold's remains were also with the plane. So Pompeo's the missing guy, and good luck finding anything in Alaska.
Good luck.
Yeah. Thank you for doing this with me, Sam.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening. Please take a moment to rate and subscribe from wherever you listen to Tragedy with a View. To get access to ad-free episodes, bonus content, and more, please join us on our Patreon. The link will be in the show notes. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook, and to share a story of your own, send us a campfire confessional email at tragedywithaview@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.